It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The last Politics Wednesday of the Obama era. Next week at this time, we'll be dropping the president-elect title for Mr. Trump and giving him the presidential title. Joining us to pick over politics as we enter a new presidential era, Hans Hassel is with us, assistant professor of politics at Cornell College. Hi, Hans.
Hello.
Wayne Moyer is with us, Rosenfield professor of political science at Grinnell College. Wayne, welcome to you.
Hi, Ben.
So we want to talk about a lot of things this hour, drawing on your foreign policy expertise, especially, Wayne, in a moment when we'll talk about how Trump's comments over the weekend about the EU and about NATO, calling it obsolete, has sent shockwaves over that continent. Also, we want to talk about the transition, the inauguration, that boycott by a growing number of Democratic lawmakers. Also, the challenges faced by Republicans in repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act. And we also want to reach out to you this hour. What do you want from the new administration in the next 4 years? Join our conversation with your observations about politics as of late and answering that question. What are you looking for in the next 4 years? 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Our email, you can tweet us at IPR Talk. We're also on Facebook. You can put your comment or question on Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. Gentlemen, let's start off with this. The L.A. Times this morning, a lot has been covered by many news outlets, but let's just pick the L.A. Times for pointing out this morning one more way in which Donald Trump is breaking the mold of modern presidents. He is unique among the last seven presidents-elect. He is the only one whose popularity dropped between Election Day and his swearing-in, according to several new polls. Surveys released Tuesday of this week show that Trump's popularity, half that of President Obama's as he was sworn in 2009, far below even that of George W. Bush. And we remember that contentious 2000 election that ended with a Supreme Court decision, the partisan split on the high court just weeks before inauguration day. So let me turn to you, Hans. What specifically has put the president-elect in this unenviable position?
Well, I think it's the result of a divided election and a very bombastic individual. I think that those two combinations make it difficult. I think the closest comparison is what you mentioned is George W. Bush in 2000, and that was a very contested election. But he was generally viewed as a fairly amiable individual who perhaps had his policy disagreements with certain individuals, but was not viewed as unstable unclear as to what he was going to do. And so I think that those two combinations, I think that that's made it much more difficult for Trump to gain any leverage in increasing his favorability ratings. He's someone who's just gone through a very contested election where he loses the popular vote but wins the Electoral College. And then he's a very controversial individual where I think even Republicans, there are some Republicans that are hesitant to support him or to say that they have a favorable view on the way that he's performing his job.
Mm-hmm. Wayne, what happened to this tradition of perhaps having a very tense, contentious election campaign and then either you're happy or disappointed on about the election results, and then you have this traditional pulling together, a sigh of relief that the election campaign is over, and let's all get on the same page here. Nothing here, or very little here, in that direction.
Well, I agree with Hans. It's part of it is Trump's personality. Part of it is that a good part of his campaign was to drain the swamp in Washington, and to come out swinging, if you would. And I think he's interpreted that as swinging immediately after the election to let the electorate know that he, in fact, is going to really shake things up. I think there have been enormous costs to this. I think his tweets, where he's been very much on the defensive and attacking people, have not been at all helpful.
Mm-hmm. Hans, how much does an approval rating, and this being the lowest one of any modern incoming president, matter in being an effective president, do you think?
it matters a lot. So I've done some research looking at the effectiveness of the president getting their legislative agenda through, specifically looking at appropriations legislation. And popularity correlates very strongly with their ability to be successful. When they say they don't want something in a bill, popularity is often the modifier by which they're able to leverage that, right? They're trying to use their pulpit to convince voters who then send a message to their representatives in the legislature. And if the president is not popular, that connection is broken, essentially. Right? One of the key levers that the president has is public opinion, right? They're not voting on the bill. They have no control over the content that goes into the bill itself. They only try to insert themselves by leveraging outside voters and leveraging partisan identification. Trump's trying to do the latter, but he's having a very difficult time leveraging any public opinion, and he's going to make it very difficult for him to win over Democrats and even perhaps Republicans in marginal seats if he continues this.
President-elect Trump, of course, responding to these low polls in terms of favorability by calling them also rigged, which he did many times. We have to remember, though, the national poll was more or less on target in terms of the overall vote in the United States. Several state polls, for instance, in the upper Midwest, were way off, and Donald Trump did criticize those during the campaign. Wayne Moyer, let me draw on your foreign policy expertise. Weekend remarks by Donald Trump sending shockwaves across Europe. We remember Donald Trump embracing anti-European Union insurgents during his campaign. Also, following that breakup this weekend, he said the 28-nation European Union was bound for a breakup. He said he was indifferent to its fate. He also said NATO's current configuration is obsolete, even as he professed commitment to Europe's defense. Let's stick with the EU for a minute. I guess the whole package here. Is there any precedent for the possibility of this sort of breach in our transatlantic relations?
No. I mean, the support from the EU goes back to the very beginning of the EU, when the U.S. was a strong supporter. And the EU is very much in our interest. Our general sense was that a united Europe would, one, be a much easier trading partner than negotiating with each country individually. And we also saw that a united Europe would also be a prosperous Europe. And a prosperous Europe would be less likely, the countries would be less likely to go to war with each other. And we had been drawn into both World War I and World War II. And creation of the EU, at least in part, was to prevent future military conflicts within Europe.
Mm-hmm. Well, the mainstream EU leaders have committed themselves to working with Donald Trump. At least that's what they're saying publicly. They've expressed hope that he will moderate his views once in office. I wonder, Wayne, do you think it looks like he will? And the second part of that, too, is this just perhaps a businessman's approach to it? He is laying out a negotiating position for things that he wants from NATO, perhaps more dues from certain countries here. That's just the way he does business, and we'll see if it works.
Well, there's two sides to this. There's one, the EU, and then there's the NATO side of it. And, yes, you could look at it as Trump trying to sort of lay out a tough U.S. stance. But in the process, he insulted the German chancellor, Angela Merkel, and essentially attacked her for allowing so many refugees into Germany. And I don't think this is a very good way to start off our relationship with the European Union.
Not only that, but he put Chancellor Merkel on the same level with Putin when asked about trusting the leaders, didn't he?
Yes, that's absolutely correct.
What does it mean, Wayne, for Europe if it may have to live without the full backing of their strong old partner here in the U.S.?
Well, I think perhaps the most significant thing that might happen is loss of intelligence cooperation. We get a lot of intelligence from European sources. A second thing is a weak Europe or a Europe without the support of the United States is more vulnerable to Russian influence, both economic influence and political influence. And we know that Mr. Putin is trying his best to intervene in various economic and political ways inside Europe, and it'll be more difficult to resist this were Europe to be separated from the United States.
Hans, what are your thoughts on this as Donald Trump sends shockwaves through Europe?
Well, I mean, I think my perspective is from American politics. I will defer largely to weigh
right.
on the things of foreign policy. But what I can say is that I think that one of the things that we know about foreign policy is that it doesn't particularly resonate with most voters. And so while this may be, you know, a thing of concern on the national stage, he may be able to do this because most most voters are not particularly aware of. These things that Wayne's talking about. What they do recognize is immigration, and by referencing immigration, Trump is very effectively kind of reinforcing a theme from his campaign,
mm-hmm.
and that's going to resonate with a strong Republican base that he's depending on to get him through through this legislative session. I
mm-hmm.
think that. I mean, so in one way, what he's doing is very disturbing for scholars of Europe. But in other ways, he's highlighting the key aspects in foreign policy that resonate with voters in some ways.
Let me just say one thing where it does come home is in trade. Europe is the United States' primary trading partner, and a divided Europe is likely to be a more protectionist Europe. And that is likely to hurt U.S. trade relationships, which will, in fact, hurt people in the United States, and that may well have political impact.
Focusing specifically on NATO, back to that question, Wayne, Donald Trump has left open the question of whether he would come to the aid of NATO allies, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, some 70 years old, to the allies who have not been meeting their defense commitments, as he sees it. He's also left open the door to a deal with Russia that would be most sort of abhorrent to most other NATO members. Have you been looking into the linkage he's making there?
What I think he's trying to do is work out a deal with Putin where somehow or other Putin would be less aggressive in the rest of the world in return for the U.S. removing sanctions that were imposed after Putin took over Crimea and perhaps accepting what Putin has done in Syria. And perhaps working better trade relationships with Russia or giving Russia economic support right now as Russia tries to transform its economy. I think this is going to be extremely difficult after the recent revelations about Russian hacking
mm-hmm.
in the political campaign.
Right, yeah, and yesterday the Russian President Putin called reports that our president-elect had been compromised by Russian intelligence, the election campaign. He called it total nonsense, said allegations were fabricated to undermine the legitimacy of Trump's presidency. This is Putin's first direct denial of the contents of this is an uncorroborated dossier written by a former British intelligence agent hired to compile opposition research. It's claimed that Trump was compromised by Russian intelligence agents during a 2013 visit to Moscow to hold a U.S. A Miss Universe pageant rally. The big question out there is Wayne, Trump has criticism for everybody, even a civil rights leader. Granted, the civil rights leader did criticize his legitimacy. He seems to have criticism for everybody except the Russian president. What is your best guess, estimation of the why that is? He just wants to improve relations.
I'm not sure what my best guess is. I mean, there's a charitable view, which is the one that you just said, that he's trying to get off to a good start with Putin and perhaps eventually get some kinds of a reduction in nuclear missiles and so on and so forth. The least charitable explanation is that somehow or other he either has business interests that are at stake in Russia that he wants to protect for the long term, or conceivably that there has been some kind of compromise. We just don't know.
Mm-hmm. On Sunday, the CIA director, John Brennan, related to foreign policy and intelligence, the outgoing CIA director, John Brennan, offered a stern parting message for Donald Trump. He cautioned him against loosening sanctions on Russia, warning him to watch what he says. Here he is on Fox News on Sunday, Chris Wallace asking John Brennan to respond to Trump's criticisms of intelligence agencies, including Trump's comparison of our intelligence agencies to Nazi Germany.
But what I do find outrageous is equating an intelligence community with Nazi Germany. I do take great umbrage at that, and there is no basis for Mr. Trump to point fingers at the intelligence community for leaking information that was already available publicly.
Mm-hmm. What do you make, Wayne, of this extraordinary friction between the incoming president and the intelligence agencies, 17 of them? Can a sitting president operate with this sort of seeming bad trust and bad blood between himself and his own intelligence agencies?
I don't think he can do it over time because he's going to need the support of the intelligence agencies, and he's going to need their unvarnished advice as he deals with various crises around the world. I think part of the problem is he's seen the intelligence agencies and the reports of Russian hacking as attacking his legitimacy as president, and I'm afraid he's overreacted in trying to establish his legitimacy, but risked alienating the intelligence agencies, which then could be very counterproductive to his presidency.
Mm-hmm. Hans, yes, let's have Hans in here.
Just chime in here is that it's not just the intelligence agencies, right? You saw some serious pushback in Rex Tillerson's hearings for Secretary of the State last week as well, you know, all dealing with this concern about the dealings of the incoming president and Russia. And I think that's you're not only risking offending the intelligence agencies, but he's also risking, I think, which is concerning, offending his co-partisans in the Senate, and I think that's a concern. We've already seen, you know, Lindsey Graham and John McCain, you know, express some strong reservations about some of the stances that Trump and his administration have taken towards Russia. And I think that's also an area where he could run into problem and lose some leverage that he might otherwise have.
Mm-hmm. I want to continue our discussion here. Just let's shift a little bit to talk about the inauguration the day after tomorrow. And we're having, over the last few days, a growing number of Democratic lawmakers, not among those attending, boycotting the inauguration of Donald Trump to be president, and also entertainers, many of them not willing to perform at Donald Trump's inauguration. One of them, Jennifer Holliday, the great singer. Here she is talking. This is an interesting story because initially she said yes, and then she backed off. Here she is talking with Whoopi Goldberg yesterday on The View about her decision not to perform at the president-elect's inauguration, which was prompted in part by a public backlash that she said also included death threats. And listen to how she explains the misconception she had about being invited to the inauguration. I want to have you comment on it. Here's Jennifer Holliday yesterday on The View.
And so I didn't think anything of it. And I was like, oh, they want me to sing. Oh, my goodness. I could see myself on the mall, like Marianne, so I'm saying America. And I'm like trying to think about what I'm going to wear. I just really did not. It didn't dawn on me that this was like a bad thing and we weren't doing America right now. I was like, we're not doing America right now.
That's the best summation I've heard in a long time. We're not doing America right now, Hans Hassel. We know what's behind that. It's speaking to the partisan divide in this country that is not getting any smaller.
Yeah, no, it's not getting any smaller. We've seen an increase in polarization, and I think we're going to continue to see that going forward.
Mm-hmm. Wayne Moyer, when you look at an inauguration, how important is that for getting a president off on the right foot in terms of tackling an agenda?
I think it's terribly important. Traditionally, in inauguration speeches, presidents try to bring the nation together. And the story is that that Trump will try to do that in his address tomorrow. But some of the tweets and all that have happened before, and the attack on John Lewis the other day, Very, very counterproductive, I think. And I think that in itself has contributed to the attack on Lewis, who said Trump's election wasn't legitimate, has contributed to others not attending. And of course, Lewis is not wanting to come to the inauguration goes back to Trump himself saying that essentially Obama wasn't born in the United States, that whole birther movement that Trump was a big supporter of in 2008.
Okay, we want to continue our discussion in just a moment. Let's listen to Jennifer Holliday in making her case there after she backed out of performing for this inauguration, pointed out that she's performed for many past presidents of both parties, even going back to Reagan, both President Bush's, also for Clinton. We'll be back in just a moment. Here is Jennifer Holliday performing at a Clinton inauguration, and we'll be back in just a moment at an inaugural interfaith prayer service for President Clinton. This is a recording from January 20th of 1997. When we come back after a short break on River to River, this Politics Wednesday edition, we'll ask our guests, Wayne Moyer and Hans Hassel, about the continuing cabinet hearings, confirmation hearings, how those are going. And also we'll talk about the pledge by the Republicans to repeal and replace Obamacare. We'll see if the Republicans are getting a unified way forward on that when we return. It's a pre-inauguration edition of Politics Wednesday here on River to River. We hope you'll join our conversation. What do you want from the new administration during the next 4 years? We'll be back after a short break and another bit of Jennifer Holliday at the inauguration in 1997 of President Bill Clinton. Midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, one day from the inauguration, tomorrow we'll look at presidential inaugurations through the lens of history. One of our guests, of course, a favorite presidential historian, Tim Walch, will be with us to look back at previous inaugurations and compare it with what's to be happening Friday. We'll be broadcasting the inauguration on Friday most of the day. We hope you'll tune in for that. Today we're talking about the inauguration as well as all the other recent politics with Hans Hassel, Assistant Professor of Politics at Cornell College. Also Wayne Moyer joining us, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. We hope you'll join us as well, 1-866-780-9100. Perhaps you're attending the inauguration for one reason or another, to celebrate it or to make your views known otherwise. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. You can email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. Leave us your question or your comment. One of our callers right now, before we go back to our conversation with Hans and Wayne, Gail Luck, I believe, is the last name, in Iowa City. Gail, welcome to the program. I see on my screen you are attending the you'll be in Washington, D.C. this weekend?
Yes, I will.
Okay. Tell us, in what capacity are you going?
Well, I am going on Saturday. I'll be there for the protest march after the inauguration for the Women's March.
Mm-hmm. What is your message in the Women's March? I hear it's a knitting project.
Well, there are several messages, and there have been several articles in the newspaper about the Pussy Hat Project, which involves sort of a peaceful, proactive approach to providing a visual response to some remarks that were made that were disparaging to women during the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the goal is to have a million pussy hats knit in all different shades of pink for women to wear during the march.
Can you give us any idea? You're from Iowa City. Any idea of how many Iowans, or perhaps just how many people from the Iowa City area that you know of? How many people coming from our state are perhaps participating in what you're doing in the Women's March?
Well, the person who probably knows most about that is Monica Moan, and she has organized the two buses that I'm riding with, but there will also be two or three buses leaving from the Coralville area, and I think overall there may be about eight buses going from Iowa, perhaps more.
Mm-hmm. Okay, why is this important for you to take the time to knit these Pussy Hat Project caps, and they are bright red or pink, I guess, and I guess if you're watching this on Saturday in any coverage, you'll be watching for those on the National Mall here. Why is it so important to take time to do this?
Well, I think this election for me, and I've voted in a number of elections, and I hope I have four or five left in me, but I think the discourse during this election was particularly upsetting, and the way that women were portrayed and minorities and people who work hard to achieve some level of success in the United States. So I think it's important to go. And I'm marching for all the women in my family, my daughter, daughter-in-laws, granddaughters. And I'm also marching for the men in my family who, thankfully, are very respectful of women.
Gail Luck, thank you very much for letting us know what you'll be doing this weekend. Gail Luck from Iowa City, thanks.
Thanks.
And if you'd like to join us, perhaps you're going to Washington, D.C. this weekend, join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Hans, let me turn to you about this. What does this tell you about the state of our politics? Is there a precedent for this sort of boycott when we talk, and every time I've turned on the news, it's a higher and higher number of Democratic lawmakers who announcing their boycotting for a variety of reasons, simply because of the divisive campaign. And Gail said that was one of her reasons. Some say it's the election and what they see as interference from Russia on behalf of Donald Trump. And others say it's a Twitter attacks against a civil rights icon, John Lewis, after he called Trump an illegitimate president.
Well, I think there are a couple of things at play here, right? To go back a little bit to what we were talking about before the break about, you know, the impact of the inauguration that can have on a, you know, president's honeymoon or the president's ability to get their his legislative agenda through. I'm not so sure it's necessarily the inauguration itself. It's the media coverage that's generated by the inauguration. And in the past, that's been largely positive. And I'm not so sure that that's going to be the case here. And I think that has a serious – could have some serious consequences for Trump's legislative agenda, for the agenda of Republicans, for politics in general. And the other thing that I thought was really interesting is I've been reading about these protests that Gail is going to be a part of, and all evidence suggests that this might be the largest set of protesters at an inauguration, and specifically a first-time inauguration. Right? If you look back at 2004. George W. Bush, his second inauguration, they had a fair number of protesters, but by then he had already taken a large number of policy positions and had alienated himself from a large number of individuals who perhaps realized that his policies were not going to be in line with theirs. And here you're seeing a protest that are estimated to be in very large numbers, and that is something that is it's unique to a first-term president's inauguration. Normally, the process of this size that you see are second-term presidents, right? Bill Clinton in 1996, George W. Bush in 2004, right? It's those those inaugurations that generate large protests. And here you're seeing, you know, mass organization at a very, very high level, perhaps even higher than those years that I mentioned, and has serious consequences.
Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, also asking what you want from the new administration during the next 4 years, 2 days before the inauguration of Donald J. Trump. We celebrate also on Inauguration Day the peaceful transfer of power that we highly prize here in the United States. It's been going on for over 230 years. Join our conversation with your thoughts 2 days from the inauguration, 1-866-780-9100. Let's talk a little bit about the Congressional Budget Office. The CBO yesterday reporting about 18 million people would lose or drop their health insurance in the first year after Obamacare is repealed. The federal agency, it's a nonpartisan agency, found that the health insurance premiums would spike another 20% to 25%. According to this report by the CBO, within 10 years, 32 million more people would be without health insurance. That projection, that coupled with the fact that over the weekend, Donald Trump says he wants to substantially expand coverage once Tom Price, and Tom Price is in his confirmation hearings this very day, is confirmed as Health and Human Services Secretary. Donald Trump's quote here, insurance for everybody, as Donald Trump put it to the Washington Post. Hans, where are Donald Trump and the Republican Congress now in terms of repealing the Affordable Care Act and then replacing it? Because this projection is here is saying if there is no replacement, first of all, 18 million people would lose or drop their health insurance in the first year. Donald Trump says, let's repeal it, let's replace it simultaneously, more or less.
Yeah, no, Obamacare is at its highest level of approval since its inception and when it was enacted. And that's, I think, partially because people are risk averse, right? They have this coverage now, and they're afraid that it's going to go away. And so the idea of repealing Obamacare is very distasteful to a number of people who have insurance and don't know what's going to happen. And then you hear these reports of increasing costs if it's repealed, and a variety of other problems that come from it. I think that one of the things that's really interesting is to see how this policy formation is coming about within the Republican Party, which, you know, is essentially going to set the agenda for what happens, because they control all three branches of government, or all three of the legislative, the two legislative branches and the presidential the executive branch, and there doesn't seem to be very good communication between, you know, congressional Republicans and President Trump right now in terms of what what they want. And it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. You could see this as, you know, as cheap talk by the president-elect, who's, you know, stating an overly ambitious goal to try to encourage congressional Republicans to try to meet that goal. Or this could be, you know, clear miscommunication where he's saying something and now Republicans are going to be, you know, trying to figure out what to do with these new statements. And based on past history, I'd almost expect it to be the latter, based on some of the things that he's said in the past and how other Republicans have reacted to that.
Mm-hmm. Do you see, Hans, that this could consume a lot of the president's first year in office, trying to get a repeal and then a replacement?
Yeah, I mean, it looks as though there's going to be they're trying to push this through in reconciliation, which is a mechanism that cannot be filibustered. It's a variety of different legislative processes, and reconciliation is this budget process, and it allows them to do it without having a filibuster. There's also some other problems with it, and I think that they have the means and mechanism to get it done. The question is, can they agree on something that's going to be satisfactory to the Republican Party, which they need in order to pass the bill?
Mm-hmm. Let's go to our phones, 1-866-780-9100. About 10 minutes left of the program. We'll try to get as much input from our listeners as possible. Tim is with us in Mason City. Hi, Tim. What's on your mind on this Politics Wednesday?
Hi. Well, I have two thoughts that have been troubling me, and I hope that Mr. Hassel or Mr. Moyer may be able to comment on them. The first is, it seems to me with all the questions about Russian influence plus conflicts of interest that the new President Trump maybe not held hostage to Congress, but will be susceptible to a lot of attacks, which would skew the balance of power, make the legislature more important than the executive. And the second one is, and this is the first time I've said it out loud, at times I want to see him fail. I just don't think it's right, and I know it's wrong to think that way.
Tim, may I ask if you were a Trump backer, generally speaking?
I was not.
Okay, but you generally say, okay, we've done an election. Let's support our president. Give him a chance is what you're trying to say, I think, right?
Well, but at times I want to see him fail.
I understand.
And I know that's not right to do, but it's a thought I have in my head. So.
All right. Thanks for sharing it, Tim in Mason City. We'll get reaction to that. Perhaps, Wayne, you can give us your reaction to Tim's idea that perhaps because Donald Trump, with his low approval ratings, perhaps under attack himself, that the legislative branch will come to the fore a little bit more than in past presidents. Do you see that?
Well, I would expect more congressional activism. That's attenuated a little bit, but in that they're both houses of Congress are Republican dominated. But what I would also say is the president has enormous powers on his own in terms of foreign policy, much more power than he has in domestic policy in terms of negotiating agreements with other countries, in terms of general diplomacy. He has to send treaties to the Senate, but he can make all sorts of other agreements without going to the Senate. So he has a lot of, and he's commander-in-chief of the armed forces. So there are limits to the kinds of powers that Congress can, in fact, assert.
Mm-hmm. Let's give a few minutes to the Trump cabinet, which is coming together. I understand from reading the Trump cabinet is coming together a little bit behind schedule compared to other recent presidents. Let's listen to a cut from yesterday's questioning. Today, Tom Price, Wilbur Ross, Scott Pruitt, Nikki Haley are on Capitol Hill for their Senate confirmation hearings. Yesterday, here's some audio from that. Senator Elizabeth Warren, with some testy questioning of Betsy DeVos during her confirmation hearing for the position of Secretary of Education. Let's listen.
Mrs. DeVos, do you have any direct experience in running a bank?
Senator, I do not.
Uh-huh. Have you ever managed or overseen a trillion-dollar loan program?
I have not.
How about a billion-dollar loan program?
I have not.
Okay. So no experience in managing a program like this. How about participating in one? I think it's important for the person who is in charge of our financial aid programs to understand what it's like for students and their families who are struggling to pay for college. Mrs. DeVos, have you ever taken out a student loan from the federal government to help pay for college?
I have not.
Have any of your children had to borrow money in order to go to college?
They have been fortunate not to.
Uh-huh. Have you had any personal experience with a Pell Grant?
Not personal experience, but certainly friends and students with whom I've worked.
So you have no personal experience with college financial aid or management of higher education?
Senator Elizabeth Warren yesterday questioning Betsy DeVos during her confirmation hearing for the position of Education Secretary. A little background, Betsy DeVos, a billionaire, vigorously defended also yesterday her work steering taxpayers' dollars from traditional public schools, arguing it's time to move away from what she says is a one-size-fits-all system toward newer models for students from preschool to college. Hans, let me ask you, as you've watched the cabinet hearings, the confirmations, and seen reports on them, too, some would characterize Donald Trump's cabinet coming together as, I've heard this criticism, billionaires and generals and many lacking expertise. Do you share that generalization?
Well, I mean, I think that those concerns have definitely been voiced. In some cases, some of these individuals are, you know, very much in line with what you would expect from a Republican administration, and then in other cases, it's obviously not. That I don't think that Betsy DeVos is that far off of a typical Republican nominee to head the Department of Education. And what you heard there, I think, is is kind of standard criticism from opposition parties when you have nominees. They have little incentive to be gentle or to be kind to those individuals that come through the process. What I would be more concerned about is some of the criticisms that have emerged from Republicans, and there's some questions about whether Rex Tillerson will make it through the Secretary of State nomination process, and that's perhaps more concerning, is when you've got Republicans that are voicing concerns and perhaps even threatening to not support a nominee of the president. That's a sign of some disconnect and dissension within the party that's very difficult for a party that's trying to govern.
Mm-hmm. Let's spend a couple minutes talking about the outgoing president, Barack Obama, leaving office on Friday with his highest approval rating since taking office in 2009, according to recent polls. A majority saying they will miss him when he is gone. A new CNN ORC poll finding approval rating standing at 60%. That's his best mark since June of his first year in office. Let's compare that with other recent outgoing presidents. He lands near the top of the list, outranked by only Bill Clinton, who had a 66% approval rating leaving office. Ronald Reagan, 64% in 1989. Wayne, what do you make of the high approval rating of Obama? Does it have anything to do with the low approval rating of the incoming president?
It might, but I think a big part of it is the dignity with which Obama has served as president. That his speeches, his conduct, his personal behavior has been unexceptionable, and it's the sort of thing that engenders respect. And I think that's what we're seeing primarily at this stage.
In one of his last moves in office, President Obama has commuted a 35-year prison sentence of Chelsea Manning. This is the Army private who leaked a massive trove of military secrets to WikiLeaks, shortened that term in prison. This was a commutation issued along with 208 others just a couple of days ago. Anything unusual, Hans, in President Obama carrying on with the tradition of presidents issuing a flurry of last-minute pardons and commutations?
This is standard practice for most presidents. George W. Bush did the same thing. Bill Clinton did the same thing before him. And so I'm not sure that this is necessarily anything new. I think that there's always one or two individuals that get highlighted because of their infamy or some sort of other noticeable consideration about their conviction, and I think that this just happens to be the individual in this case that's drawing the most attention. If it were not, there would be someone else, I'm sure. I think the standard process for evaluating what's going on is you pick a high profile individual whose sentence has been commuted or who's been pardoned and look at those particular circumstances surrounding that.
A reminder before we go say goodbye, Iowa Public Radio will be carrying live coverage of the inauguration on Friday. I'm looking at Steve's call in from Calhoun County on my screen. Will the inauguration, will NPR be checking how does one fact check the vision for our country? we'll leave that there as well. And I want to ask you, Hans and Wayne, quickly before we go, you'll be tuned in one way or another to the inauguration event. What will you be looking for? What questions are you looking to have answered in the, not necessarily on inauguration day, but in the coming days and weeks? So, Wayne.
I think the most important thing for me is will Trump, in his speech, try to bring people together? Will he give some sense of a vision that the whole country can relate to? I think that'll be very difficult, but I think that's very important.
Mm-hmm. Hans, what will you be looking for, listening for?
They're the same sort of thing. I think that you're trying to understand where he's going and what his goals are and how he intends to try to bring the party together and the nation together.
Okay, we'll say goodbye for now until the next time in the Trump presidency. Hans Hassel will be with us again in a future date, assistant professor of politics at Cornell College. Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield professor of political science at Grinnell College. Wayne and Hans, so good to always have you on the program. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ben.
A reminder for political junkies, especially President Obama holding what the White House is billing as his final news conference this afternoon. You can stay with us. It's going to begin in just a few minutes, and we'll have live coverage here on Iowa Public Radio. President's remarks, NPR analysis, coming up in just a few minutes. River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon, with help from Chelsea Hoy. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.